Ish Radio. Coming up is the news.
Continues its relentless attacks on Gaza, where the death toll has neared 26,300, mostly women and children. The International Court of Justice urges Israel to take all measures and prevent genocide in Gaza, but fails to call for a ceasefire. And U.S. and U.K. airstrikes target a Yemeni port as Sana'a persists steadfast in banning Israel-linked ships from entering the Red Sea. Now, there is no end in sight to Israeli genocide in Gaza as regime warplanes and artillery continue pounding the strip, with focal point of attacks now being the southern parts of the besieged territory. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 183 people have been killed and hundreds injured in Israeli strikes over the past 24 hours. 28 people lost their lives in the southern city of Khan Yunis alone. Israel is also pushing ahead with its indiscriminate strikes on critical infrastructure, including healthcare facilities, schools, refugee camps, and even UN-run shelters. Doctors Without Borders says Gaza no longer has a functioning healthcare system. Several hospitals in Khan Yunis remain under Israeli siege, despite warnings that many patients are at risk of losing their lives. A doctor at Al Nasser Hospital describes the catastrophic situation there.
We have a major shortage of medical staff. We have less than 10% of hospital staff that are working throughout the war. The majority of injured people coming to the hospital are those displaced in schools and residential areas. Medical equipment in the hospitals is almost non-existent, of course. The simplest things in the hospital, such as painkillers and anesthesia tools, are not available. We are trying our best to deal with patients that arrive, and we are trying to keep them alive. We are not trying to treat them as we were doing before. We are just trying to keep them alive.
Several international aid agencies, including UN, have time and again highlighted the humanitarian crisis in Gaza amid relentless Israeli bombing and shelling. The regime has, however, defied calls for a ceasefire, with several UN resolution vetoes by Israel's key backer, the United States. Now, since the start of the Israeli onslaught in early October, nearly 26,300 Palestinians have been killed, a majority of them women and children. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says its ambush Israeli forces in central Gaza, killing and injuring several. The regime has so far confirmed 220 fatalities among its troops on the ground in Gaza. Joining us now from Tripoli is Mustafa Fatouri, Libyan academic and journalist, for more on the story. Hello, Mr. Fatouri. Pleasure to have you on the program, sir. Now, Israel, in its defense at the ICJ back on the 12th of January, mentioned that this is a campaign of self-defense and that it is only targeting Hamas there in Gaza and not civilians. What do you make of that defense to its genocide case brought by South Africa?
Well, thank you for having me. Well, Israel, if you look back its 75 years of history, has always been saying that every time it kills hundreds of people, including children and thousands of people, just like we are witnessing now in Gaza, it always claims to be defending itself, it's self-defense, even including assassinations outside the Palestinian territories, you know, in Lebanon and Tunisia and the 1980s, across Europe and almost everywhere, in Iran itself and in other countries, deeper in Africa. So the claim that it is only defending itself is worthless and a fabricated lie and distorted interpretation of the UN Charter, as well as distorted interpretation of the definition of self-defense as defined by the UN Charter Article 51. So it's not surprising because Israel, in fact, does not have any kind of defense to defend itself before the world is the court, as we have seen yesterday in the court ruling. So they will always claim this, and immediately after the court announced its rulings or advisory opinion, if we like, which is compulsory to be followed and binding to every country, including the terrorist Israel. Immediately, the Israeli reaction was that, well, it's okay. We do not accept the rulings of the court, but we interpret it in the way that it does not take away our self-defense right, which is it's just tarnishing its image across the world more and more, and also isolating itself. But nobody is buying this Israeli argument of self-defense anymore. Not even its hardest and most loyal supporters in Washington and other capitals like London and around the world, whoever supported Israel one day, they are not buying this argument anymore because it's not true.
And how many civilians have you seen, sir, brandishing white flags there, including elderly women, so many men, even elderly, you've very well seen three of their own soldiers that Hamas was in a heavy firefight, set them free. They were in their underwear with white flags, and the regime killed them as well. Is there any doubt in your mind this is a campaign against civilians and not just Hamas?
No, of course, there is no doubt. Not just in my own mind, and as a writer and a journalist and a very close observer of the situation. Actually, it's across the public opinion around the world that nobody is actually believing a word of the Israeli terror forces when they say they claim they have killed so many Palestinians per day, for example. Just because they happen to be being used as a human shield, as they claim, by Hamas. That's not true. Nobody's believing that. I mean, how could you justify the killing of something like over 26,000 people, 70% of them are women and children? We are talking about around more than 30,000 kids under the age of 18 years old. And it's impossible to justify this. I mean, the world has never seen such a massacre and such a wider scale since the Second World War. And we have to remember here that the idea of the International Convention Against Genocide was actually brought into the UN and becoming a binding convention that everybody has to accept, every member state, I mean, because in response to the so-called Jewish Holocaust. And the day it was inaugurated, that was yesterday, the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, came back and said those who were claiming to be the victims of the Nazis Holocaust are occupying, are using the same experience of the Nazis in more perfected, cruel manners against the Palestinians. So nobody is actually having any little doubt, including in the corridors of power in Europe nowadays. And we have seen how the EU foreign policy coordinator, responded to the Israeli foreign minister, who was in Brussels just a few days ago, presenting a totally hilarious idea of transferring the Palestinians into some kind of manufacturing island in the Mediterranean Sea. And he is asking, without any bit of shame, blatantly, asking the Europeans to fund such a project, which is which is just a miserable idea. The colonial past, nobody ever thought about it.
We're all out of time. I want to thank you for joining us, Mr. Mustafa Fattori, Libyan academic and journalist. And we should add, since the ICJ ruling up until now, the Israeli regime has killed. Nothing has changed in its behavior. It's killed nearly 200 Palestinians. It's still targeting civilians, women and children, and still targeting hospitals and residential infrastructure there in Gaza. Meanwhile, Sean Murray is an Irish commentator and filmmaker. He joined us to share his views on the ongoing genocide in Gaza and Palestinian resistance against Israeli occupation.
There's no doubt that war crimes have been committed. There's no doubt that genocide, as it's defined by the UN, is happening in Gaza. And I think there's this only silver lining is I think that things are going to change forever now. We see that by the international support for the Palestinians. I think as filmmakers we have to be creative. At the minute we're writing a script and we're looking at a drama on Gaza that can be filmed outside Gaza but can also tell the story of what happened after October the 7th. There's worldwide support for this Palestinian cause. So again, you have to be creative. You have to find ways of having private investors involved. And there are means to make these films that challenge that hegemonic narrative. And there are many parallels between Ireland and Palestine. You know, Ireland has been disturbed by colonial settlers also. And we still are facing the consequences of that hundreds of years on. So there are many parallels. And of course, we see in the resistance in Palestine what we have been through in Ireland ourselves, having to fight against the British ourselves in Ireland, you know.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says ICJ ruling on South Africa's genocide case against Israel contributes to the regime's isolation. The senior Hamas official, Sami Abu Zuri, called court's decision an important development. He said ruling helps expose regime's crimes in Gaza. He also called for necessary measures to force Israel to fully implement ICJ orders. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also welcomed the decision, saying ruling is in favor of humanity and international law.
Palestine welcomes the provisional measures ordered by the International Court of Justice today. The ICJ judges assessed the facts and the law. They ruled in favor of humanity and international law. We call on all states to ensure that all provisional measures ordered by the court are implemented, including by Israel, the occupying power. This is a binding legal obligation. States now have clear legal obligations to stop Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinian people in Gaza and to make sure that they are not complicit.
Riyad al-Maliki said the ICJ ruling is an important reminder that no one is above the law. He said that order serves as a wake-up call for Israel and all its allies who enable regime's entrenched impunity. The Israeli Prime Minister, on the other hand, called the order a disgrace that will not be erased for generations. Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue the onslaught until what he called elimination of all threats and the release of all captives in Gaza. And reactions continue pouring in to the interim ruling by the International Court of Justice on the genocide case against Israel. The European Union said it wants full, immediate, and effective implementation of the ruling. EU emphasized ICJ orders are binding and Israel must comply. Scotland's Prime Minister said court's order is clear and must be abided by. He reiterated his country's call for an immediate ceasefire, urging Israel to stop its wide-scale killing and destruction campaign in Gaza. Spain also welcomed the court's decision, calling for the implementation of the interim measures that it has decreed. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan described the order as valuable, demanding an end to Israeli attacks against civilians in Gaza, especially women and children. Now, the International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to prevent genocidal acts being committed in Gaza, but stopped short of ordering a ceasefire, in a move that has frustrated pro-Palestinian voices. Only six of the special measures requested by South Africa were in fact granted by the ICJ, including increased humanitarian aid to be allowed into the devastated Palestinian territory.
It was a ruling weeks in the making. Lawyers acting for South Africa had requested the International Court of Justice implement special measures that would prevent more deaths and a further humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. This whilst the main case of genocide is considered against Tel Aviv, a process which could take years.
In the court's view, the aforementioned facts and circumstances are sufficient to conclude that at least some of the rights claimed by South Africa and for which it is seeking protection are plausible. This is the case with respect to the right of Palestinians in Gaza to be protected from acts of genocide and related prohibited acts identified in Article 3, and the right of South Africa to seek Israel's compliance with the latter's obligations under the convention.
Free Palestine! Outside the court, pro-Palestinian activists had a mixed response.
It is a bittersweet feeling that I'm having now. It's as if finally there is international recognition that the Palestinian people are facing the threat of genocide, that they are facing vicious war crimes. And it's as if we have to be grateful that they're finally recognizing it, right? And to hear also the evidence that the judge stated was very painful to hear, all this evidence there. But still, the people on the ground right now, I don't think it will benefit them at all on the short term. So it's also very painful to realize that.
The whole world knows it. They are exposed. That means that the people, the normal people who are not affected by the politics, will know the truth, will know that there is a genocide there. Israel cannot hide it anymore. They are exposed. And now the most important thing is that every complicit party has to know that they will be the next. Israel may escape with it, but the other complicit parties will not.
That gave me hope, and that reminded me that this is a long struggle. And even though a ceasefire has not been ordered, which is a bitter pill for us to swallow, but this is still a victory. This is the first time that Israel has been officially, quite clearly reprimanded. And as Muin Rabbani, the Palestinian analyst, said, this is a stain on them forever.
Of Foreign Affairs on 6 December 2023.
The muted response to the ICJ's interim ruling shows that it wasn't just occupation Israel that was in the dock in the building behind me, but actually it was institutions like the ICJ, like the UN's top court, because people want to know that they can have justice that is tied to what's going on and not simply to Western political interests. The European Union has said it respects the decision of the court and expects all parties to comply. Meanwhile, Israeli ministers have taken to social media to call out both the ICJ for attempting to lecture Tel Aviv and again calling the South African case anti-Semitic. South Africa, who brought the action against Israel to the ICJ, acknowledged the six measures granted would be difficult to implement without a ceasefire.
This case was very much about international bodies ensuring that they exercise their responsibility to protect us all as global citizens.
From the river to the sea!
Israel has 1 month to make its initial report to the ICJ to show compliance of the special measures requested. Palestinians have indicated they will not hold their breaths. Amina Taylor, The Hague.
Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
...31-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and I can rest and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And if next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They should work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums, and their swags and everything used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white, or bleached white, where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many. and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches, but at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife, Marion, has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had, like, constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam, and at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. It's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You can put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know? Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than three decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Well, Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
This is this for is, a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to the program For a Better Life. I am Bita, and once again, I have the chance to be here talking to you about ways, hints, stories, narrations, and hadith from the specifically Islamic point of view to help you and help myself to find the right path to a better life. As you know, in the last episodes, we were talking about some practical ways and some external methods to function as a better person in this life. But in this episode and the next episodes, we're going to talk more about the school of thought and philosophy that we have to put into consideration in order to be a better person. It must be a bit of a really complicated topic to be discussed, but I'm going to actually try to elaborate it stage by stage in order to make it clear for you, my dear listeners. So let's start with the history of philosophy and some hints and an introduction to these phenomena. In the Muslim world, philosophy has always been more than a method and set of topics with a history. It has always demanded the acceptance of specific doctrines which have been considered by some to be inconsistent with Islam. The philosophers of Islam, like the Sufis and the Shia, and important thinkers often claimed the allegiance to all three of these forms of esotericism, proposed non-literal interpretations of various verses of the Quran, and narrations attributed to the Prophet and his folk. Actually, the reaction from the literal-minded is predictable. Charges of heresy, deviation, and infidelity. In the Quran, we seem to be presented with the concept of a personal, if not anthropomorphic deity, while the philosophers and Sufis claim that God is existence itself, or the truth of existence, or absolute existence being. Islam apparently teaches that in the temporal period following death, various physical rewards and punishments are to be encountered. The philosophers and Sufis claimed that the reward and punishments were somehow simultaneous with our current lives. The resurrection of the body has also been given various mystical and philosophical interpretations, which are anathema to the literalists. The literalists are not to be dismissed as a stubborn, narrow-minded people who insist on the authority of the word of God over the use of human reason. So, I think we have to keep our introduction here, going for a short break, then we're going to come back talking more about the philosophy and school of thought to have a better life. Stay tuned.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh.
All I need to be all I need, and I know that you see how much you need to me.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to the program For a Better Life, talking about philosophy. I think in this part of our episode, we're going to have a look at a course of philosophical thought. The beginning of philosophical thought, or the history of human thought, as well as the creation of man, goes back behind history. Wherever he has lived, thought has been an inseparable characteristic of man. Whenever he has placed his feet, he has taken thinking and intellection with him. So there is no certain or precise information about the unwritten thoughts of man, except that which has been surmised by some historians on the basis of uncovered remains. However, written thought has remained behind as caravan of history has passed, since the time of written language. Among the kinds of human thought, that which is related to the knowledge of existence and to its beginning and end at first were mixed with religious beliefs. Therefore, it may be said that one must look for the oldest philosophical thoughts among Oriental religious thoughts. Historians of philosophy believe that the most ancient collection that are purely philosophical or that are predominantly philosophical related to the Greek sages, who lived approximately 6 centuries before Christ, peace be upon him. Scholars of that time are mentioned who have tried to come to know existence and the beginning and end of the cosmos. In order to interpret the appearance and changes that occur in existence, they express different and occasionally contradictory opinions, and at the same time, they do not hide the fact that their thoughts were influenced more or less by Oriental religious beliefs and culture. In any case, the free atmosphere for discussion and criticism in the Greece of those days prepared the ground for developing and taking pride in philosophical thought. That area was turned into a nursery for philosophy. Naturally, the beginning thoughts were not properly organized and arranged, and the problems for research were not precisely categorized, let alone that each category should have a specific name and title and characteristic method. In sum, all ideas were called science, ilm, wisdom, hikmah, and knowledge, or ma'rifa, and the like. So, up to here, we actually gave you a brief history about the understanding of philosophy and the history of philosophy and the school of thought about the existence and ending and opening of the cosmos. And the point here is that it was a revolutionary method for philosophy from the beginning up to here now. And in the next parts of our episodes, we're going to talk more about the different school of thoughts of philosophy. So stay tuned, dear listeners. We're going to go for a short break, then we're going to come back in a blink of an eye. In the 5th century before Christ, scholars are mentioned who in the Greek language were called sophists, that is, sage and learned. But in spite of their vast information they had about the knowledge then current, they didn't believe in fixed truth and they didn't consider anything to be definitely known or certain. As reported by historians of philosophy, they were professional teachers who taught debate, and they trained defense lawyers for the courts, for which there was much demand at that time. This profession required the defense lawyer to be able to establish any claim and to be able to reject all sorts of opposing claims. Dealing with this sort of teaching, which has often subject to fallacy, gradually brought about a kind of thinking according to which basically there is no truth beyond human thought. You have heard the story of a man who jokingly said that in such and such a house, seats are being given away. In their simplicity, the people hurried to crowd around the door of the mentioned house. Little by little, the speaker himself began to harbor suspicions about the matter, and so as not to lose out on the chance for free seats, he joined the line. It seems as if the sophists also were victims of the same fate, by teaching fallacious methods to establish and deny claims, little by little, such tendencies came to appear in their own thinking, that basically truth and falsehood depend on human thought, and in conclusion, that there is no truth beyond human thought. The expression sophism, which means sage and learned, due to being ascribed to such mentioned people, lost its fundamental meaning and it came to be used as a symbol and sign for a way of thinking according to fallacious reasoning And it is this same expression that in Arabic has taken the form sophisti, and the term actually safsata is derived from that. So, dear listeners, thank you for listening to me at this part of For a Better Life. I hope it was helpful for you in order to expand your knowledge about the philosophy of thinking, because thinking is the root of your actions, and your actions will lead you to the better life. So, thank you for listening to me. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.